Discovery.ca. A new book, Harper's Team, Behind the Scenes in the Conservative Rise to Power, is a fascinating read and quite remarkable for its behind-the-scenes insight into what happened in the four campaigns in five years it took to take Stephen Harper from private citizen to Prime Minister of Canada. The book's author, Tom Flanagan, was a senior advisor and chief organizer for Harper in two leadership races and two national elections. It is a tremendously readable and hard-to-put-down book as to how the campaigns were planned, organized, and managed. It provides a glimpse of Stephen Harper as well as an overview of how the Conservative Party of Canada came to be in these recent years. In his career, Tom Flanagan has advised not only Stephen Harper but also Preston Manning. He is a professor of political science at the University of Calgary. In 2001, he won the Donner Prize for his previous book, First Nations, Second Thoughts. Harper's Team retails for $34.95 and is published by McGill Queen's University Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Tom Flanagan. Good morning, Professor Flanagan.
Oh, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'm interested to know, you were involved in the Reform Party back in the beginning. When did you know that you were a conservative?
Well, I always considered myself a conservative in the sense of small-c conservative. Philosophically, I thought that the Reform Party might be a vehicle for that. But going way back, probably sometime in the 1970s, I had started to define myself as a small-c conservative.
I guess I'm just wondering, like, how old were you when you found out that, you know, that's the belief, those are the beliefs
yeah.
that you espoused?
Well, I was sort of off and on, but I sort of settled on that in mid-70s. I suppose I was in my early 30s by then. I had experimented with some other political convictions when I was a student, but so I would say about my early 30s, I sort of settled on that.
And why this book and why now? Because it seems to give a lot of the Conservative Party's playbook for everyone to read.
Yeah. Well, I've tried to, certainly I was aware of that, writing it, and I've tried to write it so that it wouldn't be a cookbook, a set of recipes for competitors to follow. I think if you read it, you'll see that, while I've indicated in broad brush strokes what we were doing, that you wouldn't be able to take it if you were another party and use it as a manual and imitate it. As far as why now, well, it was, I thought it was a great story. It was fresh in my mind. I'd spent 5 years living and breathing campaigns, worked on four campaigns in 5 years, and I thought it was a terrific story about how a group of people without a whole lot of campaign experience had come together and had learned how to do this and gotten to the point where they could actually win. So I wanted to celebrate what all these people on the team had done.
What is your relationship with Stephen Harper and the government now? Someone on television suggested that you're persona non grata with the government. Is that correct?
Well, I've gone 2 years ago. I came back to the university, resumed my academic career full time. I went back and worked in the campaign, the last campaign for the 8 weeks of that campaign. But other than that, I really haven't been part of the circle there for 2 years. So no, I'm an independent commentator now. I have been for some time.
Would you participate in the next campaign?
No, I don't think. No, I'm going to be a commentator for CTV television.
I'm interested to know when you first met Stephen Harper and when that was, and what was your initial feeling of the man?
When I first met him, I didn't really have too much of an impression. These were the so-called egghead lunches at the University of Calgary in the early 1990, and Stephen came along with Preston, but Preston was the main attraction. Stephen didn't say much. I really didn't have much impression of him then. That's when I met him. I got to know him in the fall of 1991. When we were both working for Manning in the Reform Party office in Calgary. And as I got to know him then, I became more and more impressed by his intelligence and shrewdness. I sort of had known him for 8 or 9 months a little bit before I got to know him better.
Were you surprised when he asked you to participate in that initial leadership campaign as well as take on these large roles in the campaign subsequent?
Well, no, because it was a logical step. He wanted to get back into politics, and he didn't have a campaign organization existing. So, you know, he's going to have to build something, and the logical way to start is with a circle of friends. And so it wasn't really just me. It was this whole circle of friends that he asked to help him, you know, sort of 8 or 9 people. And, like, initially I didn't expect to become campaign manager. That was just, that happened a little bit later when we attempted to put in place a more professional campaign team in the fall of 2001, but it didn't work out, and wasn't making progress, and had to let everybody go. And at that point, there wasn't much alternative except to go back to the circle of friends and sort of make them the core of the campaign team. So, I mean, I hadn't originally anticipated becoming manager, but at that point, it was the most logical thing to do.
At that time, when Stockwell Day was, when he was having all of his leadership troubles, and Stephen Harper was still in private life, did the Stephen Harper campaign talk to Preston Manning at all?
No, at that point, you know, Preston's position was sort of ambiguous. He was he had announced his resignation from caucus, from his seat, but he hadn't actually resigned yet. He was. He had never personally associated himself with the breakaway movement of the Democratic Reform Movement, but a lot of his closest followers were associated with it. It wasn't even clear at that point whether Preston was interested in what happened to the Canadian Alliance, you know. And then Ezra Levant had started a movement seeking the nomination in Preston's riding before Preston even retired. So the whole situation was a little bit touchy. So actually we weren't in contact with Preston at that time. At least I wasn't. I don't know if Stephen had any conversations with him, but I didn't.
Those two leadership campaigns that you ran, first for the Alliance leadership and then the leadership of the Conservative Party, at the end of it all, you won those campaigns. Were there any mistakes at all along the way?
Yeah, well, certainly in the first campaign, as I describe in the book, we didn't have a really an adequate plan for selling and processing memberships. We had a good plan for persuading existing members of the party. There was a large list of members, people who were already members, and we had a good plan for contacting them and persuading them, but our plan for selling new memberships, and then we had to process them. The rules of the campaign required the team to enter all the data into electronic templates and then transfer it to the national office. And we're talking at this point, you know, thousands of lines of data, and it became a nightmare towards the end of the campaign trying to get all this stuff processed. I mean, we struggled through it, but we didn't really have that part of it properly organized in advance. Second campaign, errors in the second campaign, I don't know, I think in the second campaign, I don't know if we had any major errors. We were perhaps a bit paranoid second campaign. We were very suspicious of Belinda Stronach's campaign, afraid that they were going to do an end run around the rules. I mean, I think you should always be a little suspicious, but I think maybe we carried it further than we needed to, led to some ill will, I guess. But as far as execution in the second campaign, I think we executed pretty well.
One of the fascinating things that you write about in the book, and you just mentioned it, about the gaps that your campaigns had, but you seemed to overcome them eventually, was trying to involve the new technology that there is out there and harnessing that for the campaign. And that involved computers, that involved these elaborate dialing machines and so on that would phone members up.
Mm-hmm.
This is new, I suppose, to Canadian politics. How were you able to use those effectively in the campaigns that you ran?
Well, it wasn't really new to Canadian. This predictive dialers and databases, I mean, these aren't new, but because of the split, split on the right, the Reform Party and the Progressive Conservatives were, or then later the Canadian Alliance, you know, they were sort of undersized parties. They weren't true national parties, and they didn't have all the resources that a national party would have. So they hadn't been making optimum use of the new technology. I mean, the technology was known, but it wasn't being put to its best use because of lack of resources. So that's why we had to start in the first campaign. We were really under-resourced with a budget of about $1 million, and so we had to use these sort of makeshift predictive dialers that work with telephone keypads, and you can only record the answer to one question. In the second campaign, we had more money to spend, and we were able to use a professional company that could do the contact in a more normal way. So it wasn't that the technology was new, although probably nobody had written much about it in Canada. Canadian politics is rather secretive, and all this stuff is discussed quite openly in the United States, but nobody been writing about it at all in Canada. So, you know, we knew it was there, and we had to put it to work, but we had to do it within the constraints of the resources available to us at each stage.
And the resources, they came from fundraising. You didn't have, in those initial campaigns, and even in the first, in the 2004 election, heavy corporate donations, correct?
We did have a corporate component. Yeah, in the first campaign, we had virtually no corporate donations. We had a handful, and the ones we had were all from family-owned corporations where people really just like giving their own money. In the second campaign, leadership campaign, for the leadership of the new Conservative Party, we did get some money in large chunks from corporations. It still wasn't the main amount, but I would say we raised maybe 25% of our money in the second campaign from corporate. But by the time we got to the 2004 election, we now had to work with the new rules, you know, that had been legislated by the Chrétien government, and that had put a $5,000 cap on corporate donations, had eliminated corporate donations and put a $5,000 cap on personal donations. So we ran the 2004 leadership campaign under the old law because it started before the new law came into effect. So that was for us the last gasp of corporate fundraising, but we did do some in that campaign. But ever since, it's been almost entirely grassroots fundraising. 5,000 limit in 2004, and now we're operating under an $1,100 limit. But it certainly hasn't hurt our ability to raise money. We do very well in that kind of system.
One of the other fascinating things about the book, and I guess you were involved in terms of harnessing, getting the resources together and budgeting, and you were quite involved in that, correct?
Well, as campaign manager, sure, you're responsible for ultimately for raising the money and dispensing it. You have fundraisers and you have accountants working for you that manage it, but, as manager, it's your responsibility. So I was very deeply involved in both phases of that, controlling expenses and raising the money.
Your wife, Mary Ann, pops up in the book a couple of times, and you talk about your relationship with her briefly, and her role in these 5 years that you were at the fore of bringing the party together and running these campaigns. What role did she play personally with you and in your activities and with this book?
Well, sure. She helped out in campaigning at times, telephone work when we were doing a lot of calling with volunteers. She spent some time in the call center, and she worked on the GOTV effort in the second leadership campaign. So she wasn't the main player in the campaign, but she would help out at times when a lot of help was needed. Apart from that, she just really kept our household going. I was really preoccupied there in this period of time. There were periods of time when I was virtually commuting back and forth to Ottawa, and I'd be gone a lot. Our daughter was still living at home at that time, and so Mary Ann had to had to keep the ship afloat at home while I was gone so much. So, you know, it was hard on her. She also went with me for a year to Ottawa in the year that I was Stephen's chief of staff, so she came along. But she was never spending a great deal of time on the politics herself. I mean, she was interested in it, and we'd talk about it a lot, but she was looking after all the other aspects of our lives.
But it was still a great support for you, especially when that in that year that you were living in Ottawa, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, it'd be pretty hard to do it without the support I got from her. So we call her the mother of the revolution. You know, it all started when she served chicken and potato salad to Harper and a group of us that were going to discuss getting into it. So I think she deserves the title.
The Belinda Stronach defection from the Conservative Party, what was your role then at that time?
Well, spring of 2004, I was no longer chief of staff, but I was still campaign manager, and that was in the period when I was commuting back and forth from Calgary to Ottawa, and I was my role was to make sure that the campaign would be ready to go at a moment's notice. We this was the period of the Martin minority government, and this was before the fixed date legislation had been passed. So Paul Martin had the legal, you know, according to convention, he had the right to go whenever he wanted to the Governor General and ask for a writ, or we might succeed in defeating the government together with the other party. So you know, we felt that an election could come almost at any time, so we were trying to be ready for it. So I was leading those organizational efforts still in the spring of 2005, and then she asked about Belinda's defection.
Well, yeah, I guess the question would be, Professor Flanagan, at the time of the defection, and I think the time of the defection provides a great lesson for how parties, for how leaders deal with those sorts of high-profile defections and the sort. Could the Belinda Stronach situation have been handled better, do you think?
I don't know. You know, maybe Harper could have tried harder to conciliate with her, but, you know, she... I kind of think she was fated to be gone. My read of it was that she was really interested in the top role herself, and she just wasn't going to be happy as part of the team. So in the end, I kind of think that it was probably fate that it had to happen, and probably made the party stronger in the long run, although it certainly was a big hit in the short run. There's no question about it. It hurt us in public opinion for a couple of months afterwards. But I think in the long run, it probably was a source of divisiveness, and it's probably better that she did move on.
An interesting part of the book is when you discuss your role as a campaign manager in terms of dealing with damage control. So a candidate or at some points an MP who's running for you may say something that is untoward or regrettable. How quickly is it, how important is it to quickly respond to kill stories that will eventually, you know, if you don't kill them, they'll control you and kill you?
Oh, well, yeah, damage control has to be, instantaneous would be the ideal, as quick as is humanly possible. You have to get on it right away, because the story can circulate and do enormous damage within a few hours if you don't react to it. So as soon as something goes sideways, you've got to jump on it. And you know, we tried to do that. Sometimes we succeeded, sometimes we failed, but we always made the attempt to get on it right away.
Stephen Harper made the comment that the provinces in the east were suffering from a culture of defeat.
Yeah.
And that hurt him a great deal. What were some of the things that you all did to sort of alleviate that and to make it better, do you think?
Well, of course, he made that comment not in a campaign context. He made it shortly after becoming leader of Canadian Alliance, when he visited Atlantic Canada. I think it was late summer of 2002. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't in a campaign context. Nonetheless, there wasn't effective damage control wasn't exercised at the time, and so that just sort of, you know, it never went away. It was always there, and 2004, still nothing really had been. I guess the lesson is that things don't necessarily go away, even with a long passage of time. Because if the other side sees it as an effective tool to use against you, they will. So ultimately, Stephen went on radio and apologized for that comment prior to the 2005-06 election, and that helped, I think. And we did win a couple more seats in the region, got a higher share of the vote in 2006. But you know, it was really just left out there for years to fester, and I think that now in a campaign that probably because it didn't happen in a campaign context, and there wasn't quite the same machinery set up to deal with it. And this was also very early days of Stephen's leadership. So I would take that as a, you know, example of how not to do it. But we got better at things after that.
It points to two of your commandments. You have 10 commandments at the back of the book. Two of them that I think would serve any political party or any candidate. One, first, the self-discipline to be careful in what you say publicly, as well as toughness to not only do thorough opposition research, but research on yourself.
Yes. Yeah, and maybe in the early days there we didn't always live up. I mean, these commandments are sort of, I'm not laying them down like a lawgiver. It's rather my observation of what, based on what worked and what didn't work. And you know, we didn't always follow those Ten Commandments in every case. It's rather, this is now looking backwards, my you know, sort of idealized version of the way we should have always done things. And so, but there were some, sure, there was sometimes some mistakes, and learning from experience to get there.
Page 219 of the book, you discuss a memo that you wrote to Harper regarding his leadership style. You call it hard-hitting in some spots. After that, it's near the end of the book, so it suggests that you had left at that point?
Well, I had, yeah, this was right at, see, what happened was when Belinda defected, we were all keyed up for an election in the spring of 2005. I was working full-time to try and get it organized, and we were mostly organized except with one big hole in the scripting, and that would have been a problem if there had been an election. But then, anyway, so there wasn't going to be an election after Belinda defected on May 19th, and at that point it looked as if there might not be an election until probably, you know, early 2006. And so we were clearly in an extended pre-writ campaign. Like, we were mobilized, and it was obvious that we were heading towards an election. Even though we couldn't say exactly when, but you couldn't just go back to sleep and pretend it was normal times. And that meant that there had to be a campaign manager in Ottawa all the time, because there's a lot of, when you're in a pre-writ period, there was a lot of things involving, for example, leaders tour or tour of other, travel of other members of caucus. All this stuff had to be managed to build up towards the campaign. And to do that, you had to be in Ottawa. And I just couldn't be in Ottawa all the time when I was living in Calgary. And so I decided that, like, if the writ had been dropped in May of 2005, I would have been the campaign manager of the election. But when it was obvious that it was going to be delayed much longer, I said, this, you know, we've come to a point where we have to make a decision. So I recommended to Stephen that he promote Doug Finley to be manager, and then I resigned as manager with the understanding that I would come back and help when the writ was dropped, which I did. So the memo to Stephen about leadership style and so on, that was written around that time when I was, like, you know, cleaning everything up and moving out, Doug Finley moving in, and I discussed the memo with Doug. I mean, it was all part of the transfer transfer of authority and trying to resolve some unresolved issues.
I guess this goes into a question of whether Stephen Harper, does he take advice well? Does he seek it? Is he curious?
Yeah, he does. I mean, he acted on most of the advice that was in that memo. So, yeah, he does take advice. He is the master strategist of the party. There's no question about that. And normally he will be, his thinking on strategy will be followed. And, you know, I think that's good because he's better at it than anybody else I've ever met. But on implementation matters, sure, he takes advice all the time, like, you know, who should be put in what position or what advertising company should hire or deal with or what telephone company we should use or what fundraising methods we should use or do we need a new computer system. I mean, all kinds of important operational matters. He normally accepts the advice that he's given as long as he has confidence in the source.
I want to ask about the Conservative Party in British Columbia. I'm calling you from Vancouver this morning. It seems to me that in the 2000 campaign that Stockwell Day ran, the Alliance support hit an all-time high. Reform Alliance support hit an all-time high. Ever since 2000, it's sort of declined. Why is that?
Well, I think one reason, it's sort of out of our control, was that in 2000, the provincial NDP was at an all-time low. There's been all these scandals, and Glenn Clark had been forced out. This NDP support provincially had fallen to about 20%. Well, that affects the NDP federal vote, too, because it's all one party, and so the provincial and federal are not segmented cleanly from each other, as far as the NDP are concerned. So it was the good luck of the Canadian Alliance that the election was in BC. The election was run at a time when the NDP was at an all-time low. So we won. We Canadian Alliance won 3/4 of the seats in 2000. But I don't know that we can realistically expect to do that well all the time because the NDP is a deeply rooted force in BC, and it has bounced back somewhat from the low that it reached. It hasn't formed a government yet, but it's doing better provincially, and it's getting back up more into its historic vote share, which is, you know, certainly above 30% provincially, and even pushing 40% in good years. So it's climbed back up, and it's dragged the federal candidates along with it. So I think that's one thing that's out of our control, and I think that 2000, it probably shouldn't be used as the standard against which you measure everything else. I think 2000 was probably kind of an exceptional year.
How do you think the Conservative Party will do at the next election, whenever that is?
You mean nationally or in BC?
In BC.
Oh, I think it'll do well. I mean, we won half the seats. We had more votes than any other party, and we won half of the seats, and I think that we'll probably do at least that well next time, but I wouldn't predict that we would sweep 3/4 of the seats as we did in 2000, but I think there's room. There's a lot of very close races there against the Liberals in suburban Vancouver and against the NDP in some more remote ridings, and, you know, I think we have a chance to take back some of those seats, but it's you know, it's tough. You're fighting on two fronts, two opponents in different parts of the province, and it's a highly competitive situation. So, so I think we can improve, but I think one should be modest in expectations.
Not only in Vancouver, but in urban ridings throughout the country, the Conservative Party and Stephen Harper don't seem to get as many votes as they do outside of the urban areas. Do you think in Vancouver the Conservatives will have some resonance the next election?
Well, you know, it's not like we're being shut out of urban areas. Conservatives hold all the seats in Calgary, all the seats in Edmonton, all the seats in Saskatoon, half the seats in Regina, several seats in Winnipeg, almost all the seats in Quebec City, a couple of seats in St. John's, Newfoundland, several seats in Ottawa. So our weakness is really just in three, and of course this is important because they're the three largest cities in Canada, Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. but it's not, you know, all cities across the country. Now, when you look at the performance of conservative parties around the world, they typically don't do as well in inner cities as they do in the suburbs. I mean, this is true if you, whether you went to London or Sydney or Chicago or New York. Parties of the left are normally taking the seats in the inner city, and I think there are some, you know, good sociological reasons for that. Conservatives all over the world tend to do better as you move out of the inner city and get into suburban areas where the population is more married people with children, families, and so on, rather than in the inner city. You tend to get a lot more single people. Parts of the inner city will have poverty-stricken populations, recent migrants, and so on. So the Conservative Party is not going to suddenly start winning all the inner city seats, and it doesn't need to do that in order to win an election. What it needs to do is to win some suburban seats that a Conservative Party should win, but that we haven't been able to win yet. There are some suburban seats around Toronto, for example, that based on their demographics, you'd think that a Conservative Party would win them. The ethnic voters are an important part of the situation. A lot of now the suburban ridings around Toronto and some Vancouver too are increasingly filled with immigrants, recent immigrants or children of immigrants, groups that have been voting liberal for a long time. So we have to break into that. We have to try and make these people understand that the Conservative Party is really better aligned with their views and their interests than the Liberal Party is. But that's going to be a long, slow job. It's not going to be done immediately. But that will be the key, actually, to establishing the Conservative Party as a, you know, a dominant party in Canada that can win, you know, more than just one race, can win a series of races and win with majorities. We've got to crack into the Liberal domination of the ethnic vote, and so, you know, the party's working on it, and I think it can be done, but I don't think it'll happen overnight.
One of the commandments that you talk about in the book, and it's been the subject of numerous speeches by Liberals, I've got a fundraising letter here from the Liberal that I've obtained that talks about you and about your book and about this idea of incrementalism, that Canada's not a conservative or a small C or big C conservative party, that a conservative government needs to take small steps, and that the conservatives have to be patient. Liberals seem to suggest that this is proof positive that there's a hidden agenda behind your party and behind Stephen Harper. How do you respond to that?
Well, I was really puzzled by that response, you know, because I wrote the book and some other stuff I've written urging moderation and incrementalism. I see those really as two sides of the same coin. If you're moderate, you know, kind of naturally going to want to take small steps. So I openly urge moderation and incrementalism, and Liberals have seized on this as proof that there's some sort of hidden agenda. I guess they say, they must think I'm just lying about it, that really there is some kind of other plan there that will be dusted off when, I don't know when, if a party won a majority or something. But, you know, actually I've been really quite puzzled by that response. I didn't anticipate that. Never occurred to me that when you openly call for moderation and incrementalism, you'd be interpreted as really meaning that you're advocating extremism. So I'm not sure what to say about that, except that I'm puzzled by it.
The next election will be fought not by an opposition party, but by an incumbent government. Will the tactics have to change, and do you think that the Conservative Party is ready for the next election?
Well, certainly I know the party is ready. I mean, the organization is there, the candidates are nominated, the money's in place, the ads are ready to be run, you know, all that's the buses, the planes, it's all there. Differences, yeah, there is a difference running as a government. In our successful election in 2000, 2006, the centerpiece of our campaign was the platform. Every day we would announce something new from the platform, and we kept that going for 7 weeks. We didn't unveil the whole platform until close to the end of week 7 of the campaign. And that was the center of our media strategy. The centerpiece every day was the new announcement, which then led to press releases and the message of the day for the ground campaigns, etc. Everything flowed from the platform. Now, it's a little different as a government. When we were in opposition, we kept our platform confidential until the campaign and then could release it gradually. But as a government, you know, you can't really keep everything confidential. Your platform is the extension of your record. Probably, I don't know when the next election might come, but, you know, it might well come as a response to the next budget. There's nothing confidential there. You put your budget out, and then if the other parties vote against it, your budget becomes your campaign platform. You can't suddenly campaign on a bunch of stuff that's different from what was in your budget.
Right.
So, the confidentiality, there's still room for maybe unveiling, some new ideas in a campaign, but confidentiality is much less of a factor. So you're running on your record. It's not so much a matter of unveiling new ideas. And I think the focus shifts much more to leadership if you're running as an incumbent. I mean, certainly that's what the Liberals did. They tried, ultimately failed, but they tried to convince everybody that Paul Martin personally was the right leader. And they didn't point as much as they should have to his past accomplishments. That always puzzled me. The way they presented him. So I think the next election will be much more about leadership, at least from the conservative side. It'll be much more about leadership as demonstrated in the record, and it'll be less about unveiling a new platform item every day, because I don't think that just wouldn't work in quite the same way for an incumbent party.
And finally, Professor Flanagan, this book is a demonstration that hard work plays a tremendous part in for one's successes. How much did luck play into your successes in the four campaigns that you ran?
Luck was important. Just to give one example, bad luck. It wasn't bad luck. It was a breakdown in procedure. I was going to say the child porn fiasco in 2004, but that wasn't bad luck. That was a mistake, breakdown of internal procedure. Good luck would be in 2006, end of 2005, when the Mounties announced they were going to investigate Ralph Goodale in his office for a possible leak in connection with their income trust taxation proposal. You know, we didn't bring that about. It was all what the Liberals had done combined with the NDP asking for an investigation. Yet it certainly helped our campaign. So, yeah, luck's important. But I would also say that good strategists tend to be lucky. And the reason for that is that over a period of time, everybody gets a mix of good and bad luck. I think it's random. You might have runs of good luck and runs of bad luck, but over a long period of time, it probably is going to even out. But the difference is that a good strategist knows how to minimize the losses incurred from bad luck and knows how to take advantage of the opportunities presented by good luck. So in practice, good strategists also have good luck. So sure, luck's important, but I don't think ultimately that luck is going to deliver a victory into your hands. It's it's what you do with it that counts.
Professor Flanagan, I thank you for joining us today, and I must say that I did enjoy the book immensely. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
The book